this week we revisit four recent features from the Culture File section at gophila.com. We take a look at the history of Philadelphia's Curtis Institute of Music, take a walk through Doylestown's James A. Michener Art Museum, while Susan Lewis visits the Rosenbach Museum and Library and the Fairmount Waterworks. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
To begin this Culture File special edition of Creatively Speaking, we turn our attention to one of the finest music conservatories in the world and an eight-decade-long driving force in Philadelphia's classical music scene. Music, beginning where speech leaves off, tells more of things human and divine, of nature, life, and love, than we can stammer in words, and tells it in a language that is universal and understandable to every human heart. The words of Mary Louise Curtis Bach, the founder of the Curtis Institute of Music. Bach's vision allowed her to share this sentiment with musicians and music lovers alike during her life, and even now, years after her death. Mary Louise Curtis Bach herself played both the piano and the organ, but more of her time and energy was dedicated to giving the musical language she so revered to others, first with efforts to help fund Settlement Music School, and later by opening the Curtis Institute of Music. The school's charter in 1924 declared its purpose to train exceptionally gifted young musicians for careers as performing artists at the highest professional level. With the money from her family's publishing fortune, Bach hired the finest teachers and charged only $500 a year. But then it got even better.
Since 1928, every student who is admitted to Curtis gets a full tuition scholarship.
Bob Fitzpatrick is the dean of Curtis. He, like many people involved with the Institute, was once a student here.
Well, I auditioned several times to get in here. I didn't feel very good the first time I didn't get in, but eventually I was accepted.
This is not because Fitzpatrick didn't have talent. It's because Curtis is one of the most difficult music schools in the country to get into. There are currently 162 students attending Curtis, just enough to complete a full orchestra, a select opera department, and a small number of keyboard, composition, and conducting students. A spot opens up only when someone leaves, which can take anywhere from 2 to 12 years. Teachers decide when students are ready to leave. Most stay between 3 and 5 years, but some do leave early, say if they get a job. Alex Hanna is a 19-year-old bass player at Curtis. He says watching friends succeed is part of the magic of being a Curtis student.
It's pretty cool to be sitting next to someone in harmony class who just got a call from the conductor of the Chicago Symphony, you know, inviting them to come play a concerto. I mean, that's pretty sweet. And the student recitals here are amazing. Like, some of the best concerts I've ever seen have been my friends. And that's really, really cool.
These student recitals are another of the long traditions at Curtis. There are usually 3 a week, and they're free and open to the public, giving students more opportunity to perform and giving music lovers a glimpse at the next Long Long or Hilary Hahn. Yes, both of these current stars went to Curtis, as did Samuel Barber, Leonard Bernstein, and Grammy-nominated composer Jennifer Higdon. Higdon, like many other nationally renowned musicians, also teaches at Curtis. Most of the teachers at Curtis are professional musicians first and teachers second. It would be like there was a school dedicated to space exploration and the students worked in NASA and took classes with the best working scientists in the world. Having access to some of the finest musicians in the world is not a small thing to students. Paul Cowart is a bass player who says the biggest reason for him choosing Curtis was not the fact that it was tuition free. It was because Hal Robinson and Edgar Meyer, his two teachers, are also among the best bass players in the world. He also says exposure to the cream of the crop is inspirational.
That's been an overwhelming result of my last 2 years at Curtis. I grew up in Wisconsin, and I met some great musicians there, but while I'm here in such a short amount of time, I've met huge names, and they know me now. And that's pretty amazing.
There's a lot about this place that is amazing. The vision of Mary Louise Curtis Bach, the Rittenhouse Square setting, the talent, the dedication it takes to get to this point, and what it takes to stay there. Students spend an average of 5 hours a day in the practice room, Plus, they have academics. With such rigorous schedules, do these talented youngsters like Alex Hanna ever wish they could act like regular college students?
I kind of wonder what it would be like, you know, to be a frat boy at Penn State or something. But I would much rather be a bass player at Curtis.
More information on the Curtis Institute of Music is available at the Culture File section of gofilla.com. And as with all the features you hear in this week's program, you can find more information at the Culture File section of gofilla.com. Now here's WRTI's Susan Lewis taking us down to the river.
There's a place in East Fairmount Park where you can stand on dry land and feel as if you're in the middle of the river. Well, almost. At the very end of a promenade, the sound of rushing water almost eclipses the buzz of traffic on the expressway. Look down and you can see where the tide finally stops. Here, swirling at the base of the dam. On one side, tidal seawater. On the other, fresh river water, which on the day we visit looks crystal clear. From a distance, the attached buildings at river's edge, with graceful arches, wide white columns, and elegant rooftop statuary, could belong to the art museum above them on the hill. The Fairmount Waterworks doesn't look like a public utility. But then again, when it was built, people had more reverence for the idea. At least, they didn't take it for granted. The city's first water distribution system was an 1801 pumping station on Center Square, where City Hall sits now. But it didn't have adequate capacity, and the city, nestled then between about 10th Street and the Delaware River, needed new sources of clean water. When the city's watering committee selected Frederick Graff to build a new pumping station, the bank of the Schuylkill was a logical site, as Drew Brown, the Philadelphia Water Department's manager of public education programs, explains.
This was the wilderness here on this side of Philadelphia, and there were no communities upstream depositing any wastes in the river. Then the hilltop was here, Fairmount, which is about 90 feet above the river level, so you've got the advantage of the elevation here, the hilltop as well.
An engine house was built between 1812 and 1815 in the style of a federal country house. In it, two state-of-the-art steam engines drew water from the river and pumped it up the rocky cliff to the reservoir on the top of the hill. Then gravity kicked in to distribute the water back down the 3 miles or so to the heart of the city. Although the steam engines worked, they caused explosions and by 1821 were replaced by water wheels. A dam, the longest in the world for many years, was built across the Schuylkill, redirecting water behind and through a new mill house. But there were still hitches. At high tide, the water level rose enough to stop the wheels from turning for about 6 hours a day. To remedy this, horizontal hydraulic turbines were installed, and the operation became not only a functional success, but a critical marvel, drawing visitors from all over the world. The city was also aware by then that sources of clean water could no longer be taken for granted. If you've ever looked at a map of Philadelphia and wondered why the footprint of the city's immense park stretches out and away from Center City in such an irregular way, the plan was, well, anything but random, as the Water Department's General Manager of Public Affairs, Ed Gruszewski, describes.
They understood 180 years ago concepts of watersheds. And so an integral part of the development of the Fairmount system was the development of Fairmount Park, where they put aside land to prevent development, to protect the city's drinking water.
Despite such efforts, over time, the river, used for so long as both a source of drinking water and a sewer, became too polluted for use. In 1909, the pumping station closed. the reservoir would become the site for the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Over the next decades, the Waterworks building was put to different uses, an aquarium, then as a swimming pool. But the still-polluted, malodorous river made outside activities less attractive. In the last quarter of the 20th century, the Clean Water Act of 1972 was enacted, which over time would help make the riverbank a more pleasant place to visit. The Fairmount Waterworks was declared a National Historic Landmark, and efforts began to restore it as a historic site. In 2003, the Waterworks Interpretive Center opened for visitors. Two William Rush sculptures sit on top of the entrances to the old mill house. The male Schuylkill chained, fighting against locks and dam, and the female Schuylkill freed, under which the visitors enter and descend into a series of rooms with exposed stone walls and high arched waterfront windows. Here you can see an 1851 turbine, pump, and wet well, and watch an orientation film in the 1815 engine house, where the pipe that led up the hill to the reservoir is still in place. Pollutionopolis, a kid's favorite, is a sculpture of mud, bottles, auto parts, toilets, garbage, you name it, inspired by the debris collected at the base of the dam. The star attraction is a video monitor with a live feed to the fish ladder, which is kind of an underwater detour that allows fish and other creatures to swim beyond the dam. Last spring, the first American river otter seen here in over 100 years was captured on the video as it swam, pausing for a moment at the camera as if to say hi. This is but one of many indicators that the water quality is improving, something educator Karen Young is keen to impress upon young visitors.
Every drop of water that comes to them comes from almost within walking distance to where they live. We don't think twice about the amount of time and energy and expense to clean both sources of water coming into us and leaving us.
Only a decade or so shy of its 200th birthday, the Waterworks continues to reaffirm its bond to Philadelphia's people, the land, and perhaps its most intimate partner, the river. The water, now cleaner, continues to flow past, stroking the shore, pausing perhaps before tumbling over the dam to salute this partnership, which as much as any other has created and nurtured the city.
Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis. Need more information? GoPhilla.com.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way.
The 1943 song written by Oscar Hammerstein for the hit Broadway musical Oklahoma. Inspiration for the song didn't come from the sparse prairie of the Great Plains, but from the land around Hammerstein's farmhouse in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. The prolific songwriter was not the only artist inspired by the rustic beauty of Bucks County. The area was a draw for artists of all kinds, among them such luminaries as Dorothy Parker, S.J. Perlman, and Hammerstein's friend James Michener, whose book he adapted for the hit musical South Pacific. Bucks County, like many American exurbs, has changed. Many of the farms have been replaced with subdivisions, where woods once grew, parking lots and shopping malls now stand. There are still glimpses of what made this region attractive. To farmers, the fertile soil. To artists, refuge from the chaos of the city. And then, as it often goes, developers. In the county seat, Doylestown, there's still evidence, though, of what once was. Nestled between highways and strip malls stands a preserved American small town with a hint of a French village. There are shops and cafes and even a thriving cultural center. Down the hill from the quaint business district is a large castle-like structure housing the Mercer Museum, and across the road stands a sturdy yet somewhat ominous-looking building.
For some time, the county thought they would tear the place down because, you know, it was a prison. It was a terrible place. It was a medieval dungeon.
But thanks to forward-thinking trends in development, reuse conquered demolition, and the 19th-century prison was tastefully transformed into a 20th-century art museum. Bruce Katziv is the director and CEO of what is now the James A. Michener Art Museum. He says its 1988 opening was not only following trends in building preservation and reuse, but also trends in museum culture.
In the 1980s, we were opening 1.2 new museums a week in America, and many of those museums, most of those museums, were focused on some kind of regional culture or some kind of regional experience.
And this new museum was no different. The renovated building is a seamless union of stone prison walls and new large glass windows exposing an outdoor sculpture garden. But why James, or Jim as he's known around here, Michener? The Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist grew up in Bucks County, and although literature is art, it's not the kind displayed in this museum, or at most museums for that matter, says director Katziff.
In 1988, a friend of Jim Michener's, Herman Silverman, visited Jim in Texas, twisted his arm, and Jim reluctantly agreed to let them use his name. I think that Jim's fear was that this community might build a new museum, but could they really sustain it? I think his other fear was, would it become a credible institution? He was worried that his name might be attached to something that perhaps he wouldn't be proud of.
And Michener's concern that his name would be attached to something that was not a success eventually led him to donate a large sum of money to the institution. As a tribute to this native son, a visitor walking into the museum is greeted with a room dedicated to Michener, with his desk, baseball, and Presidential Medal of Freedom on display. There's also a room set aside for the world-renowned furniture maker George Nakashima, who spent most of his creative years in Bucks County designing modern Japanese-influenced wood furniture. Bruce Castiff points out that Nakashima's work is displayed in museums around the world, including the Met and MoMA. But this collection is unique because the room was designed by his architect daughter, Mira, and is displayed so close to Nakashima's adopted home. And this is the main purpose of the Michener Art Museum, to collect and display the works of artists who made Bucks County home, and in doing so, capture the essence of the place that inspired their work. One of the most prolific groups of artists to call the area home were the Pennsylvania Impressionists, a group of painters who were active in Bucks County in the late 1800s and early 1900s. A colony of Pennsylvania Impressionists formed in nearby New Hope along the Delaware River, and word of the colony attracted more artists to the region. The main gallery walls have works of such prominent Pennsylvania Impressionists as Edward Redfield and William Lathrop. The subjects of the paintings are nature and small-town landscapes. The irony of this collection of paintings is not lost on Katziff.
50 years from now, one of the only remnants of the beauty of Bucks County may well be our collection, because so much of what those artists were painting back in 1920 and 1930 no longer exists.
Not that the Michener is trying to become a museum dedicated solely to images of Bucks County past. They're building a collection of contemporary art as well. And James Michener would be glad to see that instead of failing, this building with his name on the front is in fact growing. In 2002, an annex to the museum was built in New Hope. Therein is an exhibit devoted to the lives of Bucks County artists. Curator Brian Peterson lists some of the subjects.
People like Oscar Hammerstein, Dorothy Parker, S.J. Perelman, Pearl Buck. The visual artists we chose were Edward Hicks, Daniel Garber, Edward Redfield, Charles Sheeler, and writers like Gene Toomer, the great African-American writer. They're figures of real national importance who lived and worked in Bucks County.
But is this creative legacy going away along with the farmland that's being developed? Curator Peterson thinks not.
I would say, as opposed to 100 years ago when the Impressionist painters were here, it's not as cohesive a community of artists. It's much more varied stylistically, and there isn't this sense of a kind of a tight-knit community as there was then when it was much smaller and sort of in simpler times. But there's a lot of very interesting and significant artists that live and work here now, and as I say, in our exhibiting and collecting, we try to honor and focus on that as well as on the historic people.
Brian Peterson, senior curator at the Michener Art Museum, ending that report. Now in the final segment in our Culture File special, WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us on a visit to the Rosenbach Museum and Library.
In the middle of a quietly genteel residential block, a short walk from Rittenhouse Square, sits a repository of literary and art treasures known as the Rosenbach. Housed in the former home of its founders, the Rosenbach is a museum and library of fine things. But it is also a doorway into a world of stories of lives from both the past and the present literary and art world. The museum actually occupies two adjoining townhouses on Delancey Street, one at number 2008, now called the Sendak Building, where visitors enter, and the other at 2010, where the Rosenbach brothers lived. 2008 has a sleek museum feel and a gallery with rotating exhibits, which bring together individual pieces to tell larger stories, like the exhibition of original Benjamin Franklin's Poor Richard's Almanacs, many of them hand-notated by Franklin's friend Isaac Norris, which were on display when we were there. Or like the 50th anniversary exhibit, called R is for Rosenbach, where over 150 of the nearly 350,000 objects in the collection were displayed whimsically in alphabetical order to explore unexpected connections, as Judy Gustin, curator and director of collections, explains.
In collections like this that are somewhat idiosyncratic in nature, the way a collector's mind, or a really good collector's mind, ends up working is that everything has a relationship to the next thing. If you took everything in the collection, threw it up in the air, and let it land, not literally, of course, anything that fell down next to the next thing would have a relationship to it if you're just willing to ask it to tell you what that was.
Telling stories through the association of objects continues in the family residence next door, where for the most part collections are unlabeled and tours are guided. But here, the story of the Rosenbachs begins. Arts and antiques dealer Philip and his younger brother, rare book dealer Abraham Simon Wolfe, known as the Doctor because of his PhD in English, owned the Rosenbach Company from 1903 to 1953, with shops in New York and Philadelphia. It was the rare book part of the business that made the name Rosenbach famous, as the museum's associate director, Michael Barsanti, explains.
In the United States, there was something of a fad in book collecting in the 20s and 30s. And you also had economically a situation where you had some of the great families of Europe, and of Britain in particular, who were book rich and cash poor on one side of the Atlantic. And then here in the United States, you had industrialists who were cash rich and book hungry. And Rosenbach was able to buy from people in Europe some of the real great treasures in books and manuscripts in particular, and sell them to people like Henry Folger, whose collection later became the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., the Widener family, whose collection became built as the Widener Library at Harvard.
Abraham died in 1952, and Philip in 53, and the museum and library opened a year later. Aside from an opportunity to get a look at the first book printed in the United States, or a comic book made by a boy who would grow up to write Alice in Wonderland, or the manuscripts of Chaucer, Dickens, and Joyce, just to name a few, a tour of the residence is a visit back into the lives of the Rosenbachs and those whose lives they touched. The first floor rooms are furnished to illustrate their tastes. Think 18th century gentlemen. The upper floors house highlights of the collection, including works purchased by the brothers, as well as individual rooms devoted to more recent fans of the museum, like Maurice Sendak, who now has over 10,000 drawings on deposit, and the poet Marianne Moore, whose living room is recreated with her furniture and personal effects in a third-floor room which bears uncanny resemblance to her own. In Dr. Rosenbach's library, the walls are lined with shelves filled with beautifully bound or boxed books and manuscripts, as well as related things which you wouldn't necessarily expect. Near the manuscript of Ulysses sits a plaster death mask of its author, which made its way from Joyce's face after his 1941 death to Delancey Street by way of Hollywood, as Barsanti explains.
John Huston directed a film version of Joyce's short story, The Dead. While he was doing that, he was presented with this death mask. John Huston then gave it to his son, and his son, not wanting to display it in his own house, heard about the Rosenbach as the place that had the Ulysses manuscript and gave it to the museum on a long-term loan, where it was here for many years. Huston decided to sell it, and the person who bought it from Tony Huston eventually decided to have it on display here as well, so that Joyce can be back together with his Ulysses manuscript on our shelves. It's certainly a very accurate presentation. It's really kind of, it's a little scary looking.
It may be a little scary. It certainly is consistent with the creative, almost mischievous spirit that runs through this house, inspired perhaps by the Rosenbachs' own unique personalities and legacy.
It's sort of a haunted house that way. We have the brothers hovering around. So we do, I mean, they had such strong personalities, and their vision is expressed very clearly in the things that they chose to keep. They were both very smart, educated people, but they liked to take some of the world's great treasures, and they liked to have fun with them, and that's what we like to do here.
In keeping with the eclectic nature of the collection, Rosenbach reaches out to visitors in a collection of eclectic ways, as in its well-known annual Bloomsday event, when a variety of notable Philadelphians take turns at reading Joyce's work. The idea, says Judy Gustin, is to help people access the materials in ways that are fresh and new.
some people will respond well to going to an exhibition and finding their way along and reading the labels, and some people would rather come to a gallery talk, and then some people would rather experience the arts in other ways. And for Bloomsday, for instance, it's not a surprise to people to know that Joyce's novel is difficult. So why not come and hear it the way that a lot of literature really is best heard from ancient epic on down the line? Hearing it makes it suddenly somewhat clear, particularly once you add in the music and the voices.
The museum has beautiful and rare objects and wonderful stories that go with them. Ultimately, though, the greatest strength of the Rosenbach today is the same as it was when its founders were alive: the ability to make human connections with people, with the artists and writers it has drawn into its world, from Lewis Carroll, Dickens, and Joyce, to Sendak and Marianne Moore, and with those of us who, like invited guests, step through its mahogany townhouse doors.
Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis. More information on the Rosenbach Museum and Library, along with a host of other arts, culture, and historic gems, is available at the Culture File section of gofilla.com. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Jennifer Reisers and Megan Smedley. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.